Applications for a news producer, check it out at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
When I first came to Brookhaven town,
way, hey, 90.1,
there was no good music to be heard around.
Way, hey, 90.1.
Then one day I turned on the dial.
Way, hey, 90.1.
There I found music to make me smile.
Way, hey, 90.1.
I waited for a legal ID.
Way, hey, 90.1.
The DJ said WUSB.
Way, hey, 90.1.
They start each day with the rising sun.
Way, hey, 90.1.
Don't ever finish till after day is done.
Way, hey, 90.1.
So if you want good music to hear.
Way, hey, 90.1.
There's a station in Stony Brook you ought to hear.
Way, hey, 90.1.
So if you like the sounds, do take a look.
Way, hey, 90.1.
At WUSB Stony Brook.
Hey, hey, hey.
And this is WUSB Stony Brook. It's just about 6 o'clock on a Tuesday evening. And that means it's time once again for another exciting edition of Off the Wall. Thank you. And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Tuesday evening. I'm joined tonight by Kyle.
Yes, I'm over here.
Well, another week has passed, and don't think the world is in much better shape than it was a week ago. You know, I might not sound too cheery tonight, just based on the things that we're seeing coming out of Ukraine. My God, we knew this was bad. We knew this was bad when it started, but seeing the aftermath of some of the places where Russian troops have been and have since left. We're seeing massacres. We're seeing evidence of torture. We're seeing evidence of war crimes. And, you know, the thing that really gets me is just the stark denial. Oh, wasn't us. Wasn't us. Those people with their hands tied behind their backs, shot in the head, point-blank range, was somebody else. Yeah. These days, you can just do that. You can just basically flout the facts. You know, we've been experiencing that in this country for a while now. You know, everything that happens, somebody who disagrees with you can just say, no, that's not true. That's not the way it is. But the evidence points to, no, the evidence is fake. It's just wrong. It's not true. But science says this. Oh, science is biased. You know, no matter what it is, there's a way out now for anybody that takes any position. And, you know, the media is front and center taking the blame for legitimizing this kind of thing, saying that, there's two sides to everything. Sometimes there isn't. Sometimes when the facts are in, i.e. when a jury reaches a verdict, it's kind of decided. You don't get to just change the facts because they're not convenient to you. So when Russia goes and says, yeah, this is all a fabrication. Well, let's look at that. Let's look at that for a second. To make a fabrication where hundreds of people are found in mass graves throughout various towns and cities. Okay, first of all, who was it who killed them? You're saying Ukrainians in the middle of a war took time to round up their own citizens, torture them, kill them, and put them in the ground, and then tell all the remaining survivors, make sure that you stick to the story and say it was Russian troops. And you know, and for the Russian troops that happened to have been there while this was going on, let's just not get in their way. They're perfectly innocent people. They're just going to move peacefully, you know, into the next town or whatever. And as soon as they go, that's when we're going to torture and massacre our own people and have this story ready to go. And nobody rat us out. Nobody says anything that would indicate that we're up to this huge, huge conspiracy. How long do we let this go on where we just listen to them in befuddlement and say, really, that's your story? It doesn't seem to matter anymore. It just, you know, you could see it. It reminds me of the Trump statement. I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. It seems that's how they feel. They can just do whatever they want and get away with it. And if it's convenient to say, yeah, it wasn't me, they'll just say that. Evidence be damned.
Yeah, the characterization of it as fake news is sort of saying what you're implying, that it's something that is made up, and we're interpreting it as, oh, it's a fake video, but there's still bodies there. That, I mean, there's evidence. Just because you're seeing it as a video, I mean, we're interpreting the party line there, fake news, as fake video, but there's evidence. We're just seeing it as a video because it's distant. And let's not misconstrue the term. The Russian Federation wants you to believe that these dead people were, as you said, a part of a conspiracy that was made up to frame them. And it's absurd.
It is absurd. Do you think you can carry the show for about a minute? Because I left a story in the other room that I really want to read, and I can't believe it's not here.
All right. Well, will you do that?
Sing a song or something. I'll be right back.
Yeah, I'll carry this thing.
I can't believe it.
And the tune ran out. This is a great song. And the evidence really just is piling up at this point, and a lot of really concerned people from the Red Cross to the ICC to UN committees and various layers of oversight are watching. A lot of NGOs, of course, are documenting this, and the Ukrainian government and their emergency services and soldiers and people that are basically coming upon these scenes, these horrific scenes. And there are other cities that we've yet to get access to, and that's a really kind of a grim proposal to be facing going forward. So this is what was meant by things were bound to get worse as far as the kinds of news we hear. In fact, its coverage has waned a little bit, and that's unfortunate. But it is heartening when you do see people reminders and various people getting involved. But that evidence is piling up. The groups going in there are doing unbelievable work, helping people on the scene and clearing places that do have people's remains. It is it's shocking stuff, and to be on the scene, to be doing that work is harrowing and incredible and traumatizing. So I really hope people get through it, and that that we can really take heed in the next couple of weeks.
Well, it's just it's so frustrating, because you know, you just you see this with your own eyes. You hear the firsthand reports from a variety of sources. You know what happened. And you also, you know, if you still have doubts, so look at the history. Look at what Russia did in Chechnya. Look what Russia did in Syria. This is their modus operandi. This is how they operate. You know, it's not hatred of a particular nation or people by saying this. This happens to be what their particular military is known for. And we can't just say, well, we don't know enough. There was a story that came out that I just found that I left in the other room that has a headline. It's from Reuters. I want you to listen to the headline and just tell me how it strikes you right away. Pentagon can't independently confirm atrocities in Ukraine's Bucha, official says. Bucha being the area where a lot of tortured victims were found. Pentagon can't independently confirm a trial. It makes you think from that headline that maybe this isn't provable. Maybe there's another side to this, but it's rather misleading, because that's not at all what the story is saying. What the story is saying is that, and I'll read the first line from the Reuters story: the U.S. military is not in a position to independently confirm Ukrainian accounts of atrocities by Russian forces against civilians in the town of Bucha, but has no reason to dispute the accounts either, said a senior U.S. defense official. Very different than the headline. They can't possibly do it. They're not in a position to do this. But if you say, we can't confirm this, it means you have doubts. That's not what they were saying, but that's how it was reported. And I can just see people seeing that and saying, huh, maybe what the Russians are saying is true. You know, maybe there is another side to this story. No, there isn't. There isn't another side to the story. This is what happened. It's been verified. It's, you know, it couldn't be more obvious if, you know, if they had signed their names. The question now is, what happens? What do we do about this? Because clearly everything that's been done up until this point is not working. Well, it's not working quickly enough. Sanctions are great, but are they enough? How much more pressure can we put? And I know that it's foolish to jump into a confrontation with Russia. But at some point, you have to stop saying, okay, but if we do this, they're going to react this way. Because what if they do something more? You know, what if they do something that really does go over the line? And they're still going to have that same threat. You know, so we have to start thinking along those lines. How much of this are we going to take? How much can we make it hurt for them to continue doing this? I don't have the answers. I'm asking questions, hoping that somebody out there can figure this out. All we can do at this point is theorize. So don't look to us for the magic answer to all of this. But we do have to start thinking creatively, because this is a nightmare. This is a horrible situation. And, you know, if it just stops, if Russia says, all right, we're bored, we're going to move on to do something else, and they leave the country entirely, including the eastern regions. Well, okay. So what happens to all the devastation and destruction? What happens to the victims? What happens to the families of the murdered? We're not just going to let that go. We're not just going to sit around and wait for the next time for this to happen. No, this ends. This has to stop. And I'm not hearing that conversation. You know, I don't think anybody knows. I don't think anybody knows how do we get there. And I think, you know, really, naive as it might be, the only way to make this stop is from within, from Russia itself, whether it's people, you know, individual citizens, or part of the power structure, which is kind of the same thing that's there right now. But if there is some kind of a coup or takeover or just something where Putin is taken out of power, then the possibility exists for change. But that change can also be even worse. Certainly possible. That's why it's important that it be clear that more of this will hurt more and will isolate Russia more. And that can't possibly work for them. And if there are millions and millions of people who are saying the same thing, well, then that's more pressure. That, to me, is the only hope of change, because it's clear that, you know, from where we are militarily, there's not much we can do. There's little Ukrainians can do to keep themselves from being massacred. And there's no assurance that this won't continue to happen in the future. I mean, all the talk of, all right, we're going to have a compromise and Ukraine's going to be neutral. Yeah, right. You're going to be neutral after this? I don't think so. And we're going to have a guarantee that Ukraine can't be invaded again. Okay, and who's going to back up that guarantee? It's going to be the same scenario again. Because, you know what, we already had that guarantee in the past. So now there'll be a guarantee and they get invaded again, and it's the same dilemma. You know, does NATO do something about this and risk a direct confrontation with Russia or not? And painful as it is to say, not doing that is the intelligent choice. Because when you're dealing with a situation like this, it can very quickly spiral out of control, and then you're looking at something a million times worse. So, you know, we're open to all kinds of ideas here. One idea I had is, you know, we can shoot it down if you want, is to have a coalition, not NATO, a different coalition, a coalition of Eastern European nations, you know, former Soviet bloc, Bulgaria, Romania, Moldova, Ukraine, a whole bunch. And they have an alliance, and they have the same kind of agreement that NATO has, where basically you attack one of us, you're attacking all of us. Now, all these countries banded together, not including Western Europe, not including the United States, can they stand up to Russia? Maybe. I mean, Ukraine's doing a pretty good job, and all of them together could be a good thing. Thing is, though, theoretically, if these nations stand with Ukraine in a situation like this, and then Russia attacks one of those nations who happen to be a NATO ally, then NATO kicks in at that point, because then Russia has crossed the line. I'm sure there's a technical reason that can't work, but it just feels like NATO isn't enough at this point. And I know there are all kinds of issues with NATO. not ignoring the history of NATO, not ignoring the abuses of NATO, but right now, at this moment, in the present, NATO is what's keeping things from spiraling into even worse areas. So we can have that discussion, that debate, when we get past this. And we should have had this discussion and debate before this. I get that. And I know NATO did a lot of things wrong, and I know we did a lot of things wrong after the collapse of the Soviet Union. But that's not where we are now. We're in a very different place right now. I want to read you something that I saw off Twitter yesterday from a reporter named Sean Walker. He reports on Central Eastern Europe for The Guardian. And I just want you to picture this scenario in your head and how it might apply to many, many different situations. Today, I met a woman who ran a beauty salon. The Russians occupied her town, shot at her brother, stole a friend's car. 7 soldiers broke into her salon and slept there, stole boxes of beauty products and all the equipment, and defecated in a neighboring shop. As this unfolded, she called her aunt, who lives just outside Moscow, to tell her what was happening. And her aunt said, "Nonsense, that's not possible. It must have been Ukrainians dressed up as Russians. They've really brainwashed you there." They have not spoken since. And that's one of hundreds of similar stories that this reporter has heard, and many others have also reported. Does that remind you of something? Does that remind you of trying to talk to people in this country who seem to have the wool over their eyes about things that are so damn obvious, and you just can't reach them? This is what happens when propaganda wins. When there's basically a brainwashed populace. And we're seeing this throughout the world. And the people who are doing this, they tend to be friends. You know, Trump is a friend of Putin's, and the various right-wing leaders of various countries, whether it's India, Brazil, Hungary. This is all something that they have in common. And the thing that gets me is just seeing people buy into this. I don't know, maybe it's security or something. Maybe it's because, you know, you want to be reassured. You want to believe something. So no matter how crazy it is, if there's somebody who appears strong and decisive and isn't afraid to speak their mind, if they say the kinds of things that you wish are true, then, hey, who's to say they're not true? And in Ukraine right now, it's a very, very extreme example of that. Because literally, people are being killed in front of Ukrainians who tell this to their relatives in Russia who don't believe them because of what they are told by their government and by their media. You think there's a line somewhere. You think that, okay, you know, if it ever gets to this point, people will surely wake up and say, oh, wait a minute, this is too far. No, it doesn't come that way. It doesn't happen. That is scary.
Absolutely. Yeah. And a reminder to everyone that it's going on. It's planned. It's really something to look out for in the kinds of media you're consuming, the pervasiveness of this technique. It's so funny, like the energy put into drawing conclusions about all these vast conspiracies that other people are doing, when, as you said, these peer groups seem to be all sort of very interestingly aligned in certain attitudes and behaviors, and it's oddly similar in most cases, and I find that fascinating.
Yeah, And it's not that odd, though, when you think about it. It's basically, it follows a formula. A formula in the present day, a formula... But if you look back in history, the same formula.
But they're building all these narratives and conspiracies and why it's actually this, and you know, pointing to all this other stuff when that's like the sort of apparent thing. It's the other thing I got out of what you're saying is it's sort of a pre-erasure of history. Will those people in Russia ever believe that this ever that it happened? They're already conditioned to assume that their relatives are brainwashed, and just the level of atrocity, it's staggering, and you know, of course, those stories will not be told domestically, and those individuals who don't believe the relatives certainly won't hear those stories, and if they do, they won't believe them either. That then will anything we judge as outsiders or write down historically will be deemed itself propaganda of some sort.
Yeah, and I've learned, I always knew this, that when you tell people they're brainwashed, they tend to resist, and they tend to think that you're the one who's brainwashed. And I hear that all the time from right-wing media, from people that these folks on the left, they're the ones that are basically towing their party line and don't think for themselves. And, you know, to a degree, this is true of any position anywhere. So, yeah, you can always point to the most egregious examples of people acting like idiots on any side. It doesn't define everybody. And that goes for them as well. That goes for people on the right wing. But when you unquestioningly follow the party line and do what you're told, that's when the danger lights should start sounding. I mean, they sound for me when I see people around me echoing something that I might agree with, but without questioning, without thinking for themselves, just because somebody says this. Why do you believe this? Because this person told me. That's not a reason. You have to be able to explain it in a way that makes sense and can be held open to scrutiny. If presented with, you know, an opposing view, do you shut down? Do you walk away? Do you stop listening? If any of that, then you don't really know the facts. I don't care what side you're on. You need to know why, not just what. And I think that's certainly true of what we're talking about here. For instance, you know, if you talk about COVID, for instance, and you present science and facts and things that are pretty indisputable, and the response back is that everybody's part of a conspiracy and that this is fake and that's untrue, without actually presenting evidence other than accusations, that's a sign of someone not thinking for themselves, simply following the party line. And like I said, you know, you can do that on any side, but when you're able to point to scientific facts, that's a big plus. You know, that means that you're doing research that matters, that means something. Not just what people tell you, do your own research. Do your own research means reach your own conclusions, no matter what the facts actually point to. And that's a convenient way to get the result you want without having the facts to back it up. So, you know, when I look at a story like what I just read from Russia and Ukraine, I wonder to myself, how many times have we succeeded in convincing somebody on an opposing side that, you know what, you're wrong. you should listen to these facts, have them actually, you know, weigh them and say, okay, now I believe it. I mean, does that happen? It seems like it doesn't. I know I don't have a very good track record of that. I'd like to know if listeners have a track record of being able to convince people through dialogue. I mean, that's really the only way you're going to convince somebody is through dialogue, through listening to them. But at some point, if they're not open to changing their mind at all, to being proven wrong, you're never going to be able to get anywhere with them. And I fear that's where we might be. I mean, I like to think I'm open to being proven wrong. I don't see it as an attack on me if someone says, this is how I see it. But if the facts don't match that, I'm not going to be convinced. But shutting down completely just because somebody disagrees with you, that's not a way to, you know, to make any kind of progress.
Yeah, I think that's an emblem of not having the critical thinking capacity that's, you know, in a healthy condition. You know, that's being short-circuited in some way. And I don't know if, I mean, that, to make it kind of a technical thing, but I would argue that it's more people are conditioned away from using that critical thinking. And the other thing is that there's the sort of purveyors and then the distributors. People that are purveying this maybe are far more, they're cynical enough to be saying it knowing that they're lying, versus people that don't really know and they're not willing to investigate and use that critical thinking, or that critical thinking has been sort of short-circuited in some way, both saying this sort of untrue things. But the purveyors perhaps more absolutely deliberate, you know, in deliberate ways, as a sort of subterfuge, or to add chaos and to add to exhaust that critical thinking capacity, as Garry Kasparov says. So yeah, it's the sort of the intent to draw that out and make it so that either you're not questioning it, or you're not willing to investigate it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. I'm hopeful that we're able to, you know, to reach out to people and get them to, you know, at least listen to the facts. But I also, I'm tired of going over the same thing constantly.
Well, the purveyors need sort of more blunt instruments, more other languages, right? they're not willing to change course necessarily unless other compelling things perhaps help them reach other conclusions. Whereas people who are just consuming it and not critical, they may have a sort of convenient, it may be a sort of convenient thing, conclusion that they're reaching that sort of serves other interests of theirs in one, maybe, you know, my party is better than yours, you know, so this helps me reach a conclusion that serves my interests, and they're not willing to question the kinds of things they're being told and the sources they're getting it from.
Well, this is something that we cannot allow to disappear from the headlines. What's happening now is, you know, if there are people out there in our particular area who are going around saying this is fake, they need to be challenged, and they need to be challenged harshly, because it's like Holocaust denial.
I've been hearing way more of that than I really ever thought I would, but I guess I'm surprised. It's one thing to have a critical take, or just want to really look at something, or contemplate things that have been circulating, but as we said, these stories, this is going to become a body of evidence that will live on, and it's going to take a really long time, unfortunately. But the to be wrong about such things is, it's just sickening.
Well, there's two ways of being wrong. There's deliberately lying, and then there's being gullible, and just basically believing something because it's being said by somebody other than someone you don't like. So, and I see this on the left all the time, where because the U.S. government says something, whoever is opposed to the U.S. government, I'm going to listen to them instead because I don't want to believe the U.S. government. I certainly don't want to be on the same side as the U.S. government. We get this all the time. How can you say the same thing the U.S. government does? Well, because sometimes we agree on things. It happens. You know, the sun rises in the east. We both agree on that. It's not an endorsement. And you're being really foolish if you're going to modify what you believe in based on who is saying it. You know, just because somebody says one thing and you don't like that particular entity doesn't mean that you can't say the same thing yourself. Now, go ahead.
Especially in realms of expertise that, you know, you're counting on the government for, you know, I don't personally know how to take an envelope and get it across the country, you know, in a night without moving from my seat, you know, but the post office does. I may not like aspects of how they do their job, but I respect the realm of expertise that they've functioned in is well suited for that envelope getting somewhere. And I'm, you know, and it's a company, I know that, but it is an aspect of that was born out of a federal bureaucracy that we all count on and so forth. So I don't know if that's a good example or not, but yeah, you certainly can be critical of something, but also count on it.
Former president of Russia, Dmitry Medvedev, remember that name? He had a real dandy of a quote that was passed around, and I just lost it because Twitter decided to refresh the screen. Russian President Vladimir Putin firmly set the goal of demilitarization and denazification of Ukraine. This is a quote from Dmitry Medvedev. These complex tasks do not happen all at once, and they will be decided not only on the battlefields. To change the bloody and full of false myths consciousness of a part of today's Ukrainians is the most important goal. Listen to this. The goal is for the sake of the peace of future generations, of Ukrainians themselves, and the opportunity to finally build an open Eurasia from Lisbon to Vladivostok. Lisbon is in Portugal. So this is not just about Ukraine. And he said the quiet part out loud. He said the part you're not supposed to speak. And that basically shines a spotlight on the thinking that's going on inside the upper echelons.
Yeah, that's one thing that I really like to be imaginative about, like how we think of our own foreign policy, how we think of ourselves, our own national pride. There's all this, you know, chanting and chest pounding of acronyms, and that's all fine and great, you know, patriotism and being wrapped up in that. But thinking about other places and thinking about what is their religion or their political aim? How do they see themselves? What kind of ideologies? What kind of relationships to other nations, not us? Not everything is about us. And I think that's so important to double down on, as well as all of the other things that are going on, the considerations, the important sort of mechanisms and ideas that people have to confront this. But we need to really, really step back and look at just how big and how little they might think of being confronted, or what sort of large alliance they might envision for themselves. You talked about small, you know, alliances of Baltic states. There have been many of those. In fact, we watched a sort of visual a video on YouTube about this.
That
about
was former Soviet republics.
Correct. Yeah, and they had similar pacts and so forth. Mm-hmm. that helped them represent themselves.
I'm talking about Eastern European nations like Poland and the Czech Republic, Slovakia, all that, if they all banded together as former Iron Curtain countries just to stand against this sort of thing, I think it would matter. I think it would mean something. And if one of them was attacked by Russia and they happen to also be a NATO member, I think that would definitely up the ante quite a bit. And it wouldn't be NATO stepping in. You know, it would be Russia basically taking a step too far. I also wanted to mention Viktor Orban of Hungary has claimed victory in the general election on Sunday. He appears on track to deliver a fourth consecutive term. And as you may know, he has a close personal and economic relationship with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Makes it interesting. A country in Europe having that. You know what else? I saw this today. I couldn't believe it. CPAC, you know, those idiots who meet they seem to be meeting all the time. They're always meeting and saying stupid things about Democrats and about democracy and things like that. They're having a convention in Hungary. it's like all the fascist wings are gathering together. Why are you going to Hungary? You're supposedly about America, and you're literally meeting in a foreign country that has fascist overtones. So, yeah, keep an eye on that.
It's probably easier to get a venue out there.
I don't know. It's definitely easier to get people agreeing with you, that's for sure, people in the government. But, yeah, it's gotten to the point where Hungary is not really considered to be a democracy at this stage. Yeah, we could go on about this, but we only have an hour. Hey, next week we have 3 hours, by the way. We're filling in for Finn next week, so we can talk about this a little bit more if we need to. Final thoughts on this, and we've got to get to our feature.
Oh, no, I could go on and on. I just think that all of the different realms that need to be defended need to continue to be defended, and we need to continue to support and be imaginative with solutions for all of this stuff, and much faster than we ever thought.
I thought there was more to your sentence.
Oh no, you were poised. And
I'm always poised.
Well, I just saw the door open, that machine. I don't know, like...
It's there. It's ready to go. But you put a period at the end of that sentence? Ready to
period.
Go? All right, then. Then it's time for us to go ahead with the machine. And that film projector turning on for one of the last times is an indication of our feature films of the year that was. And the year that was is 2019, I believe, because we've been seeing Academy Award winning films since the Academy Awards began back in 1929. We even went before that and saw some films, going all the way back into the 1800s. And we've been talking about... you know, when we started doing this, it was 4 years ago. Can you believe that, Kyle? 4 years ago we started doing this.
I cannot believe that.
And we're reaching the end because, as I said, 2019, and they just had the Academy Awards 2 weeks ago, and that was for 2021. So we have this year, the year we're doing tonight, 2019, then we have 2020, and then we have the last one, 2021. So what we do is we see two films. We see the foreign language film, the film that won the foreign language award, and then we see the domestic film, the film that won the best film domestically. Well, and then we report on those.
So, well, have I got news for you?
Yes, please tell me.
The international and domestic winner for 2019, if you can believe it.
Yeah, David Lynch, what?
Is Parasite.
No, wait a minute. Hold on. I know Parasite is the film that we saw. You're saying that Parasite won the domestic award for the Academy Awards as the best domestic film.
It did.
And you're saying that also
also,
in addition to that,
in addition,
Parasite won the award for best. They changed the name, by the way. It's called the International Film. It used to be called the Foreign Language Film. As of 2019, it changed to International. You're saying the same film won domestic and international?
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
Why did we see it twice?
Nah.
That was stupid. Wow. I thought it was very similar.
Well, this actually was something I had missed when it came out and won, but wanted to see it.
Okay, well, let me just surprise you with something then.
For our regular feature, films of the year that was, as we journey back into time and watch every film that has won the Oscar for Best Film. You know, we've had the Oscar awards, the Academy Awards, in the last couple of weeks for this year, or last year, I guess. And you know what happened? The film that won Best Picture also won Best International Picture. I didn't know you could win both, but apparently that's the first time it's ever happened. We've been watching the Oscar-winning film for this country, and I just assumed the international film was just a different category. It just seems kind of weird. And in all the time that they've been awarding that, it's never won Best Picture. A foreign film has never won the Best Picture, which I think is kind of wrong. You know, if that was possible, I think it, you know, something like Bicycle Thief should have definitely won Best Film, you know, eclipsing all the American films. No way an American film has been better than a foreign film every single year until now.
Well, I think it speaks to the distribution methods, and also sort of points out how distribution and theaters in general right now aren't great ways to be exposed to this kind of stuff, but the platforms and the connectedness and the ability to see different types of productions, like on a platform, a streaming platform, really make the world a smaller place. That is, if the content can actually get to people. But it is, I mean, it's the times we're living in, but also, sadly, I think in a lot of ways also points out how the average theater is going to show just American big budget films. There's not a lot of opportunity to go to a regular Cineplex.
Okay, well, I have to stop you there, Kyle. That was us 2 years ago when that actually happened. That's us doing the same feature, I think February 18th, 2020. It was shortly before we shut down because of COVID that this happened, that the same film won both titles, and we were talking about it back then. And now we're talking about it now because we finally got to that year and have seen the film Parasite. So a little trip down memory lane as we talk about memory lane. So Parasite, what do you think?
It was really, really interesting. I liked it. I liked how it looked overall. The production itself was strong.
We should mention that South Korean. It's a South Korean film. So
yeah,
that was the international part of it.
And it's about the Kim family, and they have they're a poor family who has all these sort of odd, they have temporary jobs, and they eventually have this scheme to work their way into this rich family's house, and begin taking over jobs
one by one. There's four of them. One person gets hired as a tutor, and then he recommends somebody, his sister, to teach another kid in that household, and then they start doing some devious things to get people in certain positions fired, and then have somebody ready to take over their position that they recommend. And before you know it, all four of them are working in that rich family's house.
And what they don't know is that the housekeeper there, who they had fired, is one of the casualties sort of their becoming integrated and becoming mm-hmm. employed in their jobs. She comes back and
she has secrets of her own.
She herself was keeping someone hidden in a shelter.
A shelter below that the family who lives in the house didn't even know about because the old housekeeper lived in the house before that family. She came with the house because she knew the architect of that particular house, and she knew there was this huge cavern downstairs.
It's South Korea.
Three-story. And apparently a lot of houses have that because they're worried about what North Korea might do.
That's right.
Oh, that was one of the favorite parts of the film where during one of the scenes, somebody is just imitating a North Korean newscaster. If you've ever seen North Korean newscast, it's worth looking up on YouTube. Do that. You will see the way they talk, the inflection. And when this person is doing that, it's spot on. And I think that is what got this film accolades certainly in South Korea and probably all around the world, because wow, that's it exactly. I don't think anyone else has ever done it so well.
Those elements, yeah, the detail and intricacy and overlap and commentary on status or class and work. And eventually, I think we both realize this. I don't know. I think it's a big theme is who is really the parasite? Who is really exploiting the other, and in what ways, you know? Mm-hmm. And maybe there's sort of these loops of exploitation and injustice.
Well,
or
let's study that. Parasites. You assume right away that parasites, well, it's got to be these four poor people that are basically injecting themselves into the rich person's or rich family's home. They must be the parasites. But wait a minute. The rich people, they can't do a thing for themselves. They need these other people to drive them, feed them, clean up after them. Maybe they're the parasites. But then you ask yourself, how about the person? And it changes throughout the film. The person who literally is downstairs hidden and basically living off of scraps from upstairs that the people upstairs don't even know is downstairs in the same house. Might that be the parasite? And I think that might be the one, because otherwise it would be called parasites. It would be plural and it's singular. So that made me think that. But there's another thing in the film, that there's a theme of staircases. Everything is going up or down levels, whether it's in one part of town or another part of town. It's just fascinating. And there's all these themes similarities that you come upon. It's worth taking a close look at when you see this film. Well,
their original household is underground, or it's at a basement level. So there's this literal thing of,
it's
like
below ground,
a lower class.
It floods. Yeah. It gets full of water, and yeah, these things happen. But you know, you can't tell if the film is supposed to be a comedy or a drama.
Well, it's funny you say that, because the thing that I'm reading just to get a guide, it's described on Wikipedia as a black comedy thriller film.
Yeah, that pretty much covers it, I think.
I didn't get the comedy that much.
Oh, I thought it was...
I mean, the thing that you mentioned about the newscaster, North Korean newscaster, that was great.
Well, I mean, okay, maybe not comedy, but lighthearted, because they just kept injecting themselves, and it was kind of funny how they were getting people fired. Okay, for instance, the housekeeper was allergic to peaches. All right. So what they did was they just basically sprinkled peach dust in the area, and she came down with an allergic reaction. And then the father, who is serving as the limousine driver at that point, happens to place himself in the very hospital that she goes into. He takes a selfie of himself in the waiting room with her in the background. And then he casually mentions to the woman of the house, is this the housekeeper that works here? Because when I was getting my checkup yesterday in the hospital, I noticed that she was there, and she was talking loudly on the phone saying that she had tuberculosis. And I just thought I should mention that because, you know, there's a young child in the house. Maybe that's not the best thing. And then he basically engineers it so that, with more, distributing peach dust around the house, she starts coughing in front of the woman of the house. He pours chili sauce into the garbage can that she just was coughing into.
A napkin.
To make it seem like she's coughing up blood. And of course, she gets fired because for one reason or another, not necessarily because of that, but obviously the woman of the house wants her out at that point. That was kind of funny. It was also kind of horrible, but it was, you know, you found yourself laughing at them scheming and plotting like that.
Pointing out the ridiculousness of the wealthy as well.
Of course.
That was a consummate point of ridicule.
I did think it was a bit unrealistic. Well, obviously the whole thing is unrealistic. But, you know, we start off with them trying to get a Wi-Fi signal in their basement apartment. They're literally standing up by the window holding a phone, and they're trying to connect to coffee shops and basically neighbors who keep installing passwords and thwarting their efforts. You know, to me, that was humorous and understandable as well. They basically are trying to come up with a better life. They're folding pizza boxes, you know, trying to earn money doing that. And then they have an opportunity, or the son has an opportunity to be a tutor at this rich person's house because of a friend of his. What was unrealistic to me was, okay, did they know that was going to happen? Did they have a plan ready to go where all four of them would get hired by the same place? It just seemed like they didn't really have a plan, and this just fell out of the sky. What would have happened had that not occurred? What would have been the story then? It just seemed like, you know, at one point they even say this was not part of the plan. They seem to be ready for a signal. As soon as this person gets a job, then we all try and piggyback onto that. But how did they know they were going to get a job in a rich person's house? It seemed a little bit sketchy.
Well, remember the father's wisdom is the best plan is a plan is no plan at all.
I like that. I live my life so that way. The best plan is no plan at all.
They do speak to that. Yeah, he's commenting and saying that. And that's a sense of like survival, this sort of being in your element, flying by the seat of your pants, figuring things out, moving quickly, being agile. A lesson we can all
learn, when you make a film, you should have a plan. And I just think, you know, in that particular case, it could have used a little bit more, you know, exposition on that. But, you know, I'll let it go because it was an entertaining film. It was very good. I don't know if it was the right film to win both awards. I'm sure there were other really good foreign films. We call them international films now. As of this year, it changed to international films. And I'm sure there were other good films that were domestic as well. But you know what? It saved us a few hours because we only had to see it once. Although it was released in black and white as well as in color. So that's an interesting little fact
there. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's something. Any other final words on our film from 2019?
It was written after Snowpiercer in a 15-page film treatment.
Okay, well, that's a fascinating fact. Wheel it out, please.
All the way, and watch the molding.
I don't know if it's going to last another 2 weeks, but we'll see. You can write to us here at Off the Wall, otw@2600.com. That is our email address. And please, you know, if you have thoughts on either our film feature or on our interpretation of the state of the world, if you have a possible solution to keep us all from incinerating into a nuclear abyss, this is the time to write that piece, otw@2600.com. Those are the numbers, 2600.com. Finn is up next, and we will be filling in for Finn next week, as we mentioned, for a total of three hours. That'll be fun, so we'll see what we come up with then. We will see you next week.
Yeah, I know what I would do.
Good night.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Yes, and how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Yes, and how many years can a mountain exist before it is washed to the sea. Yes, and how many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? Yes, and how many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Yes, and how many times must a man look up before he can see the sky? Yes, and how many ears must one man have before he can hear people cry? Yes, and how many deaths will it take till he knows that too many people have died? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.